You are listening to a sermon by Janice Kreider, recorded on Sunday, March 15, 2020, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
I'm pleased to see that many of you are not here. That sentence is for those of you listening on the recording. Today I will tell stories of how people encountered or experienced God. Right now we are hearing scary stories on the news from all over the world about COVID-19, the shutdown of entire countries, inadequate medical facilities, the crush at airports, and so on. But as Christians, let's also look for stories where people encounter God. There are going to be lots of stories. In the last two Sundays, Henry Klippenstein described some of the ways that we encounter God. In his first talk, he emphasized relationships rather than creeds. He also mentioned other ways, such as art, music, and nature. In his second talk, he told about the Vineyard Movement and their way of training people's minds to hear God's voice. He also told about contemplation, which he finds very meaningful. Along with you, I appreciate the depth of his talks coming from a lot of thinking and life experience. This is going to be a bit lighter. My excuse is that I haven't lived as long as Henry has. So I have four stories, two from the Bible and two from life. With apologies to Henry, I could entitle this talk, How Do We Encounter God, Part 3, because I have encountered God in the two stories that will come from my life. The first story is the one in John 6, feeding the 5,000, and it's in your bulletin. It's John 6, 1 to 14. After this, Jesus went to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, also called the Sea of Tiberias. A large crowd kept following him because they saw the signs that he was doing for the sick. Jesus went up the mountain and sat down there with his disciples. And skipping to verse 5, when he looked up and saw a large crowd coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we going to buy bread for these people to eat?" I'm not going to read the rest of the story because you're very familiar with it, I'm sure. This story is in all four Gospels, so it's considered very important. I picked the Gospel of John because it's the only one mentioning the boy. I like the idea of the boy, his seeing the consternation of the disciples and innocently offering up what might have been his family's food for the day. Behind the scenes, I'm sure there was a mother or a grandmother who encouraged him to offer this inadequate meal. This part of the story, you can believe it. It's almost believable. However, the story on the whole is hard to believe with our 21st century minds. The four Gospels disagree if the number of those fed was 4,000 or 5,000. And perhaps there were two events, because the place where it's supposed to have happened varies. But the sheer numbers are most difficult to comprehend. Even 200 people, how could they have heard Jesus without the fancy equipment we have today? Mm-hmm. Well, they were probably young people with excellent hearing. And maybe Jesus went from small group to small group and left them to discuss his teachings among themselves and ponder the meaning, like we do here following our sermons. At the conclusion of the story, we read that the people said, "This is indeed the prophet who is come into the world." Why did they say this? Whatever actually happened at that gathering, the people encountered God. In Jesus' teachings about love for each other and for God, his blessings for the poor, his healing of the sick, and the generosity that he must have inspired among more people than the one boy, resulting in many being fed. I had originally thought of bringing those little fish crackers to pass around. I quickly decided, and the week went on, no. All in all, it's difficult to accept how this could really have happened. We don't have unbelievable things like that happening today. Or do we? It was Halloween and a Thursday, and the refugee food bank at the Sherbrooke Mennonite Church was just opening its doors at 9 a.m. when I saw one of the volunteers walking into the parking lot with a young man. This was Barb, who lives fairly near the church, and she said that she found this man sobbing at her front door. Barb is a very warm and hospitable woman, but she didn't know what to do, so she brought him to the church. He was tired and very cold, so we had him come inside. One of the women got him a cup of coffee, which he drank. I looked for a warm jacket, but I could only find another hoodie, so he put that on over the one he was already wearing. I found a woolly blanket. Hannah Laurie got him a cinnamon bun, but he didn't want to eat it right then. He was very distraught and saying a few English words, but also speaking in another language, which we didn't understand. We didn't know what to do. A woman from Afghanistan had come early to pick up her groceries after dropping her children off at school. She saw the young man and the rest of us gathered around and came over to where he was sitting. It turned out that they both spoke Urdu. Perhaps she had fled to Pakistan, as many people from Afghanistan have done. He was from the Punjab. He was very emotional, but he was able to explain his situation in his own language to her. She frowned as he was speaking because it was a sad account. He'd come here from Montreal and rented a suite, but the owner took both his rent and the deposit money and did not let him occupy the suite. He'd been wandering outside for 3 days. In English, he said, "My religion didn't help me." Whether that meant that praying didn't help or whether the Punjabi people in the neighborhood didn't take him in. He was both tired, resting for a time on a sofa in the hallway, and restless, walking around outside after the church secretary found a match. We volunteers and others who are part of the community were still at a loss of what to do, but soon Sherbrooke's community pastor turned up. He also did not have the resources to handle the situation, but he knew that Teresa would be a person to help. She is employed as an outreach worker by MCC and the Spanish Church to provide support to refugees and other persons in trouble. She came over from her office at the 52nd Church and tried to find a place for him to be housed and cared for. She contacted Covenant House, which is for youth up to the age of 24, which is what he was. But they did not have space at the time, so he ended up temporarily at the Union Gospel Mission. What if Barb hadn't opened her door? What if it hadn't been a Thursday when the food bank is open? What if there wasn't a food bank at all? What if Barb was not a volunteer at the food bank? What if the woman from Afghanistan hadn't come early for her groceries? What if MCC and the Spanish church didn't have an outreach worker? And what if the young man had been older than 24? Well, probably someone would have phoned the police and they would have handled his situation. And there's a PS to this story. Someone here in Point Grey knows that I volunteer at the food bank on Thursdays, and on that morning, they texted me a photo of beautiful leaves and a short, encouraging text. I thanked them and said there was going to be a challenge that day because I had to do some driving beyond my comfort level, that doesn't take very much, to deliver some groceries. Neither of us knew that this other challenge would occur when I told the person later that there was an extra challenge I received this email saying that they, quote, had a sense, unquote. Can we write off the happenings in this story as just fortunate coincidences? Or is something else at work? I would like to put forward the influence of community, in this case, Christian community. When there is a natural disaster, such as a flood or tragic accident, people tend to bond together beyond their family units to provide support to each other. I think that it is part of our God-given spirit, whether we believe in God or not. We here at Point Grey experience community, and we cultivate a sense of others' needs. People at the food bank, refugees and former refugees and volunteers, are developing a community of support for each other. The people following Jesus in the story from John were already part of a Jewish community, and they benefited from his teachings on how to be a better community and care for each other. And now for another story, and this is a believable one because it involves doubt. It's Matthew 11, 2-6, and it's in your bulletin. When John heard in prison what the Messiah was doing, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, "Are you the one who is to come, or are we to wait for another?" Jesus answered them, "Go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor have good news brought to them. And blessed is anyone who takes no offense at me." John was in prison. Prison in those days didn't have many amenities, and his disciples probably had to bring him food. Despite this contact, John got depressed, because he could not do the teaching of repentance that he knew was still needed. He doubted that Jesus was carrying on the work, as John had earlier thought he would. But to John's disciples' question, "Are you the one who is to come, or are we to wait for another?" Jesus does not reply yes or no. Jesus, he's famous for dodging questions and changing the subject. Jesus is not about a simple yes or no. He told John's disciples to open their eyes and observe for themselves what is going on. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor have good news brought to them. People were encountering God. John's message of repentance had gone on to a new level. I don't want to give you a false impression. At the food bank, all is not perfect with one big happy family. I heard that someone was concerned because, quote, the gospel was not being preached, unquote. But as I look around, this is what I observe. The hungry picking up free bread. A baby without a father being cuddled by a grandfather figure. A postpartum mother getting hugs and support, well, maybe not hugs these days. A depressed person being surrounded by caring people. Toddlers living in cramped apartments, enjoying a larger space in which to play. Persons with mental challenges doing meaningful work and benefiting by meeting new people, including children. Indigenous people finding a friendly ear. People without papers cooking lunches for all of us. What am I seeing? Is the gospel being preached? Are people encountering God? One day, a Muslim man made this statement, "God is watching." When I was cataloging books at the Mennonite Center in France last summer, I came across a small anthology of Christian texts from the first centuries. I was struck by a visual image that Abba Dorotheus, a Palestinian monk who lived in the 6th century, described. And there's a crude drawing of it in your bulletin by someone who's not an artist. And this is what he says, where I kind of was inspired to make this drawing. Imagine a circle drawn on the floor. Imagine that this circle is the world and that the center is God. The rays are people's paths. The more the saints have the desires to penetrate the circle, the more they approach God and each other. The more they approach each other, the more they approach God. This works in the opposite direction too. When one separates from God in going toward the exterior, one distances oneself not only from God, but also from others. And if one separates oneself from others, one also distances oneself from God. And this is something to ponder in a new way with our current need for social distancing. Last Sunday, Henry described this necessary connection between encountering God by contemplation and by loving relationships with people around us. I'll close with these words from Henry's talk. Some argue that contemplative practice is private and narcissistic, and the time could more profitably be spent serving the marginalized. Father Richard Rohr, who is an avid advocate of contemplative prayer, challenges that perspective. The center from which he has operated for 30 years is called the Center for Action and Contemplation, and he explained that the most important word in that title is "and." And from Richard Rohr, it's a quote, "We need both compassionate action and contemplative practice for the spiritual journey. They feed off each other, and it does not matter which comes first. Without action, our spirituality becomes lifeless and bears no authentic fruit. Without contemplation, all our doing comes from ego, even if it looks selfless, and it can cause more harm than good." Now I'm really going to close. I want to quote Matthew 22:37-39, where Jesus puts these two ideas together succinctly. "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment." And that's the contemplative, experiencing God, worshiping part. And the second is like it: "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." And that's the action and relationship part. Over the years, people have asked, "Who is my neighbor?" And that is a challenging question for us today.